Hey folks, welcome to episode 21 of the Whiskey Ring podcast. My guest for this episode is Pam Howman, Michter's Distillery Master Distiller Emeritus. Michter's has really been a wonderful partner in my whiskey journey and in the journey of this podcast. And I really want to thank Andrea Wilson and Dan McKee right up front for making the connection to Pam. If you haven't listened yet, you can hear my double episode with Andrea and Dan on episodes 8 and 9 of the podcast. You can also watch the video of the podcast and the interview by joining as a Patreon supporter. So the idea to interview Pam came out of a very unlikely place. We were on the Bourbon and Banter online community and just chatting about things. And some article came up about Peyton Manning and Sweden's Cove whiskey. And the basic premise formed like this. Do people in certain positions and with certain titles in the whiskey industry deserve those accolades? Or are they more receiving credit with very little to actually show for what they've done or supposedly done? While there were several specific names thrown out as part of this conversation, I'm going to keep those to the Bourbon and Banter community as I have no interest in shit-talking people or evaluating what they are or aren't worthy of as part of the podcast. In a review, in an article, that might be a different story because it's a different platform, but that's not what the podcast is about and it's not what I want it to become. So how does Pam fit into this story? Well, starts in late 2013, early 2014, when she left her longtime position at Beam, where she had been for 15 years, to join the then fledgling Michter's team as they opened their Shively facility. At the time, Michter's was a very small operation, especially compared to what they are now, and really compared to the behemoth that is and was Jim Beam. Pam moved from what was then the largest producer of bourbon in the country, the Booker No plant, to a brand new site producing next to nothing in comparison. Unbeknownst to her at the time, or to Michter's owners, the Magliocco family, by taking the role of master distiller, Pam became the first woman since Prohibition to be master distiller at a Kentucky Distillers Association distillery. Try saying that 5 times fast. The KDA at the time represented a few dozen distilleries, and now it's grown to a little over 40, but don't let the pieces of that minimize the importance of Pam assuming the role. Just because it was Kentucky, just because it was since Prohibition, just because it was, KDA only distillery, that may be the truth, but let's be very clear here how important and monumental this change was for women in the whiskey industry, for the industry as a whole, and what it did for women who have come later. That being said, before we go any further, I'll tell you that I ask one, maybe like 1.5 questions about that topic. Pam has been asked 6 ways from Sunday about being the first female master distiller at a KDA distillery, about the women who have followed in Kentucky and beyond. And look, not to take anything away from Pam or from the women who have followed her, but I wanted to make this episode not only just about Pam, but to try to incorporate something different about her story. One event, as important as it might have been, is not her entire career. And that's really what we talked about. We talked through her time at Michter's, her time at Beam, as a supervisor in multiple roles, her transition into the whiskey industry after a life in Western New York in a completely different field. Of course, the question had to be asked, but hopefully I asked it through a different lens and such to elicit a new story or two by doing so. You can now support the site and the podcast for as little as $1 a month, plus new and improved benefits for the $2.50 a month and $5 a month tiers, including exclusive content, free glassware after 6 months, and additional benefits as the group grows, such as barrel picks, live events, and more. If you are a Patreon subscriber, or if you'd like to become one, keep this in mind. My Patreon subscribers had access to the audio and video of this episode 2 months before this episode is going public. If you want early access to episodes, to special episodes that may air only on Patreon, you want to sign up now. Trust me. Next up, Whiskey Ring Podcast is looking for sponsors. If you're a whiskey company, an accessory company, or a subscription service, reach out to see how you can be a sponsor. There are only 2 more spots being opened, and I am going to be picky. So if you're interested, please reach out ASAP and let's talk. If you haven't yet, please follow Whiskey My Wedding Ring and the Whiskey Ring Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and subscribe to the newsletter on whiskeymyweddingring.com. If you like what you hear, please consider supporting the site and the podcast. You can help out, like I said, for as little as a dollar a month on Patreon. Thank you also to our sponsors, Mash and Grape and Cairncraft, who are providing discount codes for Whiskey My Wedding Ring followers and Whiskey Ring podcast listeners. You can subscribe to the Whiskey Ring podcast on your favorite podcast platform today. We are on Podbean, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and pretty much every other major podcast platform. Every subscription listen helps us get sponsors, secure guests, and ultimately get more content to you. Also, keep in mind, even if you're not listening on a site that does allow ratings, please do jump over to Apple Podcasts, to Spotify, to Google Podcasts, and add a 5-star rating and review. It really makes a huge difference to the podcast and to what we can do going forward. All right, that's enough of me. Thank you for listening and supporting, and please enjoy my chat, with Pam Hallman, Mixer Distillery, Master Distiller Emeritus. All right, welcome to another episode of the Whiskey Ring Podcast. My guest today is Michter's Master Distiller Emeritus, Pam Hallman. Welcome.
Thank you, David. Nice to be here.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. I've had the real pleasure of talking with your former/current colleagues, Andrea and Dan.
Yes. I think they told me that. Yes.
Yes. We had to date, what is my longest episode? I think it was like 3 hours. I had to split it into two.
Oh, wow.
They were a lot of fun. But of course, being in the Michter's family and being in the Beam family as well, I wanted to get you on and talk to you a bit about your experience. So thank you for taking the time today.
Yeah, no problem at all.
All right. So why don't we start? Let's start at the present. You know, so you retired.
Is that the right word? I guess it is. I still dabble and do things for Michter's, and you know, if people call me and ask me, I never say no. I've had several people call and ask if I would do a tasting or things like that, and especially in the area that I'm at right now. And this, Michter's, sales rep down here, Ruth Westrick, she'll call me every now and then if she's got something going on and saying, hey, if you want to stop, we'd love to have you. So I try to do it whenever they ask. But the whole object was to be able to spend more time with my family and have my family come first for a change. It's always been my job that came first to a certain extent. You know, I had to be places at night, on the weekends, and so forth. And that can get to be much. And so we decided that, you know, it was my decision. However, I think my family liked it also. I wanted to spend more time with my grandkids, with my kids, you know, an extended family. My mom, she lives in New York, Syracuse area, and she's 91. And so I wasn't getting to see her as often as I would like. And so now I get to go up there at least once a month if I want, every other month, whatever, and get to spend time and do things with her too.
And that's something that's not really talked about too much, is that, you know, distilling, and more than just distilling, but the entire operation, it's not a 9-to-5 most of the time.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, yeah. You know, nights. Yeah. I mean, we were regularly entertaining people at night, you know, that people that would come, important guests would come for visits to Louisville. And of course we would entertain them, take them out to dinner at night and that sort of thing. And then weekends, you always had shows or whiskey fests or whatever. And then on top of that, I was traveling. I mean, I was representing Michter's traveling all over the world, actually. I mean, I went to China, went to Australia, all over the U.S., Canada. So I've been all over, you know, traveling. And those take a lot out of you, too, those trips. I'm not as young as I used to be, so jet lag was kind of a problem for me.
I feel you on that one, believe me. No, but it's true. I think there is a romantic aspect of, or an aspect that becomes romanticized, let's put it that way, of distilling. Yeah. Of, you know, you're in front of the still, you're in front of the spirit safe, and figuring out the grains, and it's really beautiful. And it is. I mean,
it is. I loved every minute of it.
Right.
And don't get me wrong, I loved every minute of it. Enjoyed my job, but it is demanding. Not unlike a lot of other jobs. So, you know, a lot of other, jobs are just as demanding, I'm sure. But you know, it was time for me. Other people like to stay on, as they age and get older and older. I mean, this way I can pick and choose when and where I want to go.
I mean, absolutely nothing wrong with that. I think it's a great way to approach it. And I think there's a generation of distillers and people in the industry. I'm using the phrase distillers, but I really mean distillers, blenders, brewers. I mean,
sure,
in the industry,
sure.
Who are about the same place in their careers. Let's say like a Fred Noe.
Yes. Kind of,
Who are and Eddie Russell. Jimmy's at the next one, but
Jimmy's a whole nother generation.
They're gonna just find him in a warehouse one day, and it's gonna be beautiful. But but
he's a wonderful man. He's so much knowledge and just so accommodating and so pleasant. I've never met a nicer man.
That's what I've heard. I mean, I think. I'm not sure if I'll have the chance to interview him one day, but it's definitely a goal to at least get down there and hopefully meet the man. So I was thinking there's this group of distillers of whom I would put you in that same group, who are right at that point in their career where it's either, you know, do you retire? Do you push on to your either, you know, next in line or in some distilleries next of kin, and
right,
and it is a different approach to say, you know what, I from what it seems like I'm really happy, I loved every minute of it, but now I can sit back, I can, as you said, pick and choose, I can see my family, I can do all of these things. And I know some of the others in that group are gonna work probably right into the warehouse ground someday. Yeah. You know, and like I said, it'll be a very romanticized thing, but at the same time, you know, how much do you gain or lose from that? So
and I think it's also different when your family at one point owned the business, or you know, you grew up in the business. Mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily have that connection, so it's a little bit different. I mean, for somebody like Fred, I mean, I can understand that, you know, I mean, that's his family. That's his heritage. You know, that's what he's leaving his children, you know, so that's kind of a little bit different, you know, so to speak. But I was happy to turn over the reins. There's great people at Michter's. I had a hand in hiring most of them. And they were brought up with us in that temperament of quality. And so I knew it was in good hands, and I knew it was the right time for me.
Perfect. Perfect. So, I mean, that's a great starting point to, you know, we'll start working backwards in a way. So I think the person with whom you've had the longest working relationship would probably be Dan, correct? Dan McKee.
At Michter's. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Dan was with me at Beam. I hired him at Beam as the supervisor, and then it was just happened to be luck, happened to be a conversation one day, and we were looking for somebody, and he was looking for a new opportunity, and so we got him on board at Michter's, and he's done a terrific job. And of course, Andrea, that's another league altogether.
Definitely, of course. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on when you're looking for someone, let's say you're the master distiller or in a position to hire a high level position like that, what you looked for, in hiring and eventually hiring Dan, but what you looked for that?
Honestly, my feeling on any employee that I hire is going to be they need to be willing to do anything, whatever it is. I've packed boxes as master distiller. I packed bottles and boxes, you know, lots of different, what people would consider menial tasks. To me, there's no menial task in the distillery. If it's needed to be done, you need to do it. And that's just the way it is. I think because people with that flexibility and that openness that are willing to try anything, do anything, will learn everything, because they're not afraid to learn something new, whether or not they think it is related to their job somewhere in the future that might come in handy. For sure, I've learned that throughout my career in many different jobs. But that's one thing. I mean, don't get me wrong, the education, we obviously look for that and experience, but experience can be in different fields too. We've hired many distillery employees and distillery operators who never saw a still before in their life, but their backgrounds may have had some kind of leadership role or some kind of ability where they started from the bottom and worked their way up. They're hardworking. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what you ask them to do, they're happy to do it. And I think a lot of the employees that we hired at Michter's, and I talk most about Michter's because that was the last place that I was, but we're willing to do that. I mean, this was a startup. So you're looking for a unique person for that kind of startup environment, because you do have to be willing to be flexible and do all kinds of things. Now, there are limitations to that when you work in certain companies, because if you have, obviously, organized labor, things like that, you have limitations. But I can say in the same realm, I think even at when I was at Beam, same kind of thing. When we were hiring people, they didn't necessarily have to have distillery experience, but had to be hardworking and trustworthy, committed to be able to do whatever you ask them to do. I think it's more about an attitude than about what you're qualified for.
Definitely. And I appreciate that insight, because it's, I've found in interviewing people, and I keep looking to the side to my notes, that's why I keep looking over to the right. You know, interviewing people or meeting them in person, that energy is usually there. Like especially the best ones, is just the energy is there. You can tell that they're ready to either stay till 9, 10, 11 at night if they need to, or correct, drive 2 hours to maybe meet 5 people and introduce them. And it's,
exactly. Yeah. It's all about an attitude, and you can generally tell in a very short time in an interview if you have any experience whatsoever interviewing people. You can generally tell. I have a good sense about people when I meet them and their personalities, and you can pretty much tell if someone's going to fit in the environment that you have. We had a really good team, and you want to make sure that they can fit in that team as well. It's not just about doing the job. It's about fitting in with the whole team and being able to work together as well. Working singly is one thing, but working with a team is something else. And not everyone can do both.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I think that's, again, as I intimated, I think we're going to work kind of chronologically backwards a bit through this. So okay. The next step I wanted to hit was, you know, when you moved from Beam to Michter's, so from an outsider standpoint, you're moving from this behemoth, I think is really the best way to put it.
Pretty much.
Yeah, it's the biggest bourbon producer in the world, the country and in the world by extension, to what you just described. It's really a startup at that point. This is around 2013, 2014. Michter's they had their first plant at that point, but you know, it's even now they're small as by Kentucky standards, but much bigger than they were then.
At that point.
So what was it like?
When I started, there was no hard, there was no how do you want to say it? There was no distillery, so to speak, Michter's distillery, a place that you went to that, you know, this is the distillery. We were building that. And that's why I was hired, was to build that and help design, build, and staff this.
That was the Shively plant, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, correct. I went to Michter's in 2013 in the winter, well, fall, I guess it was, October, I think it was, of 2013. And 2015 is when we actually started the still on site. So for 2 years, what we did is we designed, build, and staffed that facility. And actually what I did was work on with the team, the recipe and so forth to ensure that it was going to be exactly what we were doing from our producer. At the time we were contract producing. So they were doing it to our specs, but of course we're a different facility, you know, our still might be a little bit different. Our setup might be a little different. So you had to work at that a little bit to get that was one of the things Joe asked me when we first sat down, him and Willie, was, can you reproduce this? Do you think you can, you know, reproduce this? I said, yes, I think I can. There are no guarantees in life, but I believe I can. Knowing the procedures and what we're doing right now, they're doing right now for us, I can reproduce that. And so I think we did a really good job. I think it was a very smooth transition. No difference. The product was pretty much the same. No product is exactly the same. Every barrel is different, but you know, same characteristics and same things we were looking for. So I think, but going from like, get back to the point, the behemoth Jim Beam to Michter's was a very different mindset for me. It was completely different. I mean, you're going from doing one mash. Well, probably, let me think about this, 15 mashes in a day to going to 2 mashes in a day. Mm-hmm. So you're talking a huge difference. Same mash, same size mash, but very different volume. You know, you're talking millions of gallons, multi-millions of gallons with Beam. And of course I was at the Booker No plant, which was at that point, I believe that might be changed by now, but at that point it was the largest bourbon distillery in the world, as far as volume went. And so going from that, and we had just had a huge expansion. That was why Joe actually reached out to me or knew of me. We had just gone through a 7-year expansion, starting with every part of the distillery to increase volume 50% at Jim Beam. And I was on the team. I was the manufacturing part of that team, the distillery part of that team, to help implement that. And we were just to the point where we had gotten everything up and running again. We had everything running the way it was supposed to be. And we were at the capacity that they expected. And that's when Joe approached me. Joe and Willie approached me. I was quite honestly shocked, to be honest. I said, I said to him, where did you ever hear of me? Because I'm this person at the Booker No plant that, you know, at Jim Beam, it was Freddie No that is the person that everyone sees. Mm-hmm. They don't see or hear of the people who run the plants. He said, well, you know, he goes, I went out in the industry And I talk to people who make the stills. I talk to engineers. I talk to other people in the industry. And I said to them, if you had to hire a master distiller, who are your top five people? He said, and everyone I asked, you were in the top five of everyone's list. He said, so I said, I need to talk to her. And I said, well, that's interesting. And part of that was because of that expansion. I was working integrally with people like Vendome and other engineers in the industry and other people. And so that's how it happened. It was quite a big decision for me, though. I was very stable. I'd been there for 15 years. I was kind of at the top of my game there. I had just done a huge expansion. No one gets to do stuff like that. You know, that's like a once in a lifetime thing. And then here someone's offering me to start up a new distillery. So how often do you get to do that? So my husband and I talked about it, and I had been planning on retiring, actually. At the time I was 58. So I thought at 59 and a half, I would leave Beam and just be done. But I said, why not the last 2 years do something exciting, something different, you know, instead of kind of riding on the train here that I've made. So I said, what have I got to lose? I'm going to try it. I really liked Joe and I liked Willie. I liked what their philosophy was. It was all about the whiskey and being able to make the best quality product I could and not have to worry about, well, how much is this costing? How much is that costing? It's just a different environment when you're working for a place like Beam. It's a huge manufacturing facility with stockholders. And, you know, when you're beholden to stockholders, you are also beholden to the penny, and you have to worry about those pennies and making the most of what you can at the best quality that you can. It's a different philosophy than making the best quality you can, no matter what the cost is. So it was hard for me to actually wrap my head around that, believe it or not. For the first year I was at Michter's, it was funny because when we first started up that new still, Joe kept calling and asking, you know, how are things going? How's it going? Is it going good? I said, yeah, it's going great. Going great. I said, we're getting this many gallons per bushel, you know, and I'm telling him all the stats, right? And he goes, okay. What about the whiskey? How is that whiskey? And I said, oh, it's good. He goes, Pam, I don't care about the rest of that stuff. The whiskey is what I care about. Okay, I get it. And so from then on, I realized, hey, this is a different ballgame and I can do what I want to do and make the best quality whiskey I can. So it was interesting. It was very interesting.
Devin, that ethos comes through, I think, like I said, having talked to Dan and Andrea and also to Joe offline previously, that kind of, it's all about the whiskey. It's ready when it's ready.
Correct.
The 10-year-old, for example, the 10-year-old could be 12, 13 years old and mm-hmm. it's sold as a 10-year-old. It's really about when that whiskey's ready. So I can mm-hmm. say that still kind of suffuses the entire operation.
Yeah. It's all about the taste profile. And, exactly. And you know, that's true throughout the whole facility. For every product that we make, whether it's the regular bourbon, which is your, you know, everyday bourbon, or the 20-year bourbon, or the 25-year bourbon, we're going to not put it in that bottle until it is ready. It's just the way it is. And that's a interesting and different approach than I was used to at Beam.
And I should say, just before interviewing Dan and Andrea, I got the chance to try my first Michter's 20-year-old.
Oh.
So now I still have to try the Celebration or a Celebration and one of the 25-year-olds, but one of those three is at least off the list. So I'll hope to find the others.
that 20-year-old is a special product. It very much is. And all of those products now, it's getting to the point where everything was from the facility at Shively. It's very close.
Yeah.
Should be very close.
So two questions came to mind in terms of the transition. And the first one, feel free to say if you can't answer this. But as you said, you moved to Michter's in the fall of 2013. In 2014 was when the Beam Suntory merger happened, acquisition.
January of that year.
As you were debating whether or not to leave Beam, whether to join Michter's, were you kind of aware of that merger taking place, or?
No, as one of the small fry, I would consider, even though I was a distillery manager, you know, those kind of decisions were way beyond my job grade. So we were aware that something was happening, you know, things were being done that weren't normal Beam procedures. But what that was, I mean, sure, there was a lot of talk out there, but we had heard that talk before, years before, you know, lots of times for different things. And so we knew that something was going to be happening, but what that might be, we did not know. Suntory had visited, so we kind of, you know, thought something's going on with them. Are they, you know, what's going to happen here, you know? But you have no clue, you don't know. And so that really didn't play into my decision at all. That really had no bearing on my personal decision, because I really didn't know anything.
It's just something that came to mind as So the other question that came to mind was, you know, as I said before we started recording, you have been asked six ways from Sunday about being the first woman master distiller at a KDA distillery.
Sure.
Distillery Association Distillery. So,
right.
You know, so if for listeners, if you're listening for the first time, I'm not going to ask that question exactly, because you can find that in numerous publications. So I wanted to kind of address it in a different way, and really just try to focus it on one question. And I think the way that I want to frame it is twofold. Number one is, again, during that thought to transition to Michter's, was that accolade a selling point, something that was mentioned at all, or something that was realized?
No, not at all. When I met with Willie and Joe, Willie was the master distiller, and Willie was in great health. There was never any mention of, you know, me being a master distiller. And that was not even something on my radar, to be honest. It wasn't something I was looking for. I was not looking for that in my career at all. I just enjoyed doing what I was doing. I thought this was another great challenge. It was always thought, I guess, or just maybe just surmised that I would take over for Willie when he decided he wanted to step down. But that was so far into the future for me that I never gave that another thought. I mean, Willie was like, you know, like we talked about Jimmy Russell. Willie was like a Jimmy Russell. Willie was going to be in that warehouse and in that distillery until they had to carry him out. There was just no other way about it. And so that really never entered in my train of thought. I guess everyone always surmised that I would take over for him. And that's what Joe was looking for. But, you know, I wasn't that young either. So it kind of wasn't something. And I had told Joe straight up when we sat down in the first meeting, the three of us, I said, look, you know, because we had talked about, you know, I had told him quite frankly, I was getting ready to retire from Jim Beam. And he goes, well, that being said, you know, if you took this job or, you know, whatever, would you stay long enough to get the whiskey done, you know, and get us transitioned? And I said, Joe, I'll never leave you in the middle of anything. I would never leave anybody in the middle of anything like that. I said, and who knows? I may like what I'm doing so much, I don't want to retire. Well, yeah, that's kind of what happened, because I ended up staying. You know, I loved it so much, and I love the team, and working for the Maliocos was phenomenal. They're great people. And so I stayed a lot longer than I was planning to work. So, but that was never really part of the decision. In all honesty, I never really thought about there not being another woman master distiller, because I really didn't know that. I mean, I guess I just assumed that there might have been one years and years ago, you know, back in pre-prohibition or even after prohibition. You know, there were a lot of women in the industry. I never really thought about it. In fact, when they did announce my promotion and me taking over the reins, the KDA actually had to look it up. They had to research, because they weren't sure. They went back through all the records that they did have, and that there were records for, and found that I was the first woman. Like I said, that even crossed my mind, to be honest.
The Whiskey Ring podcast is now brought to you by Mash and Grape. I'm a huge fan of Mash and Grape. They ship to most states nationwide. They have great private selections and a great membership program called the Dark Spirit Society, of which I'm a member, that gets you even more private selections, plus free shipping on orders over $95 anywhere that they ship. For Whiskey and My Wedding Ring fans and Whiskey Ring podcast listeners, Mash and Grape is offering 20% off your first month of any Mashbox subscription, prepaid or ongoing. Just use code WHISKEYRING at checkout. That's mashandgrape.com. Search Mashbox Club and use code WHISKEYRING at checkout for 20% off your first month of any Mashbox subscription. The Whiskey Ring podcast is also brought to you by Cairn Craft. I use Cairn Craft's Cairn Caddy bamboo glassware carrier, the Cairn Caps bamboo lids, and Cairn Cradle glassware hanging racks every single day. And definitely when I'm tasting new things and have a lot of things to get through. Nobody else is making carriers for your Glencairns like Cairn Craft is. Plus, they've got infinity decanters, glass lids, Glencairn brushes, and more. Whiskey Ring podcast listeners can get 10% off their purchase with code WHISKEYRING10 at checkout. Just go to cairncraft.com, pick any of those incredible products that I use on a daily basis, and use code WHISKEYRING10 at checkout for 10% off your purchase. Now, back to the episode.
And I promise this will be the only other question on this particular topic.
No problem.
So as you said, the KDA went through their records to find it out. It's worth noting that not every distiller in Kentucky is a member of the KDA.
Correct.
Most of them are, but
a lot of the smaller ones aren't.
Right. I'm curious, in either that time period when it was announced or in the subsequent years, are there any names or people that, obviously specifically women, who came to your attention who would have fit the profile or would have fit the accolade if not for the KDA qualification?
Well, there was Mary Ann was made a master distiller when they the old Taylor distillery, when that came on board, when they started redoing it and rebuilding it, they actually named, she was a master taster, I believe, at Brown-Forman. And she went there and they announced that she was their master distiller. At that point, she really hadn't made anything from that distillery yet. They weren't working or anything. But she went on to do that. Yes. That's a small, still, I think it is probably a smaller entity.
That's a Castle and Key now, I think.
Correct. Yeah. Castle and Key. The name escaped me. Castle and Key is what they named it when they took over and started redoing the grounds and all that. It's a beautiful place. Beautiful place. Yeah. And then Marianne, she was there for a short period of time, a few years. And I don't believe she's there any longer, though.
Right. I think now she's on her own venture as kind of a consultant and distillation consultant. I use this reference a lot, but kind of a Dave Pickerel model.
Yeah. And there were a lot of other little smaller distilleries that then named women as well. Trying to think what some of them were, like Lisa Wicker, I think at one point was master distiller, maybe at Huber.
All right.
Or was she not master?
Oh, she's
there. I don't know. She's now at Widow Jane, but Lisa is a very good friend of mine. And I know that she was, and that probably would, it might've been after, I don't know. But around that time, women, more and more women were getting accolades, so which was a good thing. I mean, that was a good thing. So, and if them naming me had anything to do with it making it easier on any of these other people, that's awesome, you know. But I don't believe that's the case. I think that they legitimately, I mean, there are a lot of qualified, good qualified people out there, women and men, and I think being recognized is a nice thing now.
Wonderful. And yeah, as soon as you mentioned Lisa Wicker, I immediately thought Widow Jane. I'm New York based.
Oh, you are out of New York City?
Yes. Okay. I'm in Queens, in New York City.
Oh, okay.
But I was in listening to a, like I said, another podcast I think you had done. You know, you're from outside of the, was it Syracuse or Rochester area?
Syracuse. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So my wife and I both met. I went to school at Binghamton.
Oh.
So, and my, you know, our one of each of our parents, I think, went to, obviously, I know my dad. I can't think of whether her parents went at the moment. But so we're, you know, we were always going up and down to Syracuse to either visit the, like the Carousel Mall, Dinosaur Barbecue, things like that. So.
Yeah.
In terms of you know, Widow Jane and New York distillers, those are one of the groups that I really like to highlight and hope to highlight more in the podcast and the website, is because it's just New York pride. I'll put it flat out like that. So
there are a lot of good people outside of the Kentucky area now. I mean, you know, a lot of distilleries popping up all over the place, bourbon distilleries, and you know, Texas, I mean, West Coast, New York, they're all over the map, I should say.
Yeah. I mean, we're recording this on October 5th and, tomorrow. So October 6th, an episode I just taped with, Westward Whiskey, with Miles over at Westward Whiskey, is coming out. And that's a whole different ball game with just doing American single malts. I'll tell you, I flat out asked him, would you ever do a bourbon or rye? He said, this is not what we do. And
well, I mean, everyone has their, you know, it's kind of neat. Everyone has their niche and what they're good at and what they like to work on, you know, and when you find that, it's kind of neat because there's so many different options out there, even in bourbons. I mean, no two bourbons really taste alike. I mean, I've really not tasted any bourbon that tastes exactly like another one. So there's so many options and there's so many different things you can do in the process to make differences that I think it's limitless. I mean, the ability to experiment and all of that. that's one of the things I love to do. I love to experiment. We did a lot of that. I'm sure you'll see some of those things come out in the future at Michter's. At least I hope they do. That means they were good.
Yeah, I was going to say it's just a year. Well, I guess, I mean, let's say 2 to 3 years now, you're the 10-year-old that would have been produced, that mm-hmm. you would have produced is going to come mm-hmm. out. Mm-hmm. So that's an exciting thing to look forward to. It's always a scramble to find those, especially up here in New York. We're kind of, in the city at least, we're cursed and blessed. We get all the allocations and all of the stuff, but we also have so many people hunting for them that
it's hard to find.
It's impossible. I almost always have to rely on the eyes, ears, and generosity of friends who are like, I just found this on the shelf, can you grab it for me? And I that's just the way you got to do it around here. But
I think that's almost anywhere, actually.
The only benefit, and we do take it for granted here in New York, is that because we're such a big market, I mean, we're the biggest market, let's be honest, in the US, things that are allocated but impossible to find somewhere else, like let's just say a bottle of Eagle Rare or basic just Buffalo Trace bourbon, it's top of mind because I was just talking to someone about those particular products. But I know that I can go to my local store and find a bottle of that, little inflated price, but I can find the bottle. And even that, the very basic, like just regular shelf products in other places, you can't find even for secondary prices. And that just amazes me.
No. And I was reading an article in a magazine here just yesterday or the day before, a whiskey magazine about the secondary market and just how outrageous some of these products have gotten as far as price goes. It's really too bad because we make those products so people can enjoy them. And you have to, unfortunately, be in a certain level to be able to afford to enjoy them, mm-hmm. which is too bad. I mean, you know, I guess the only good thing is that we do a lot of on-premise sales. So most of the people that carry our products would be able to get those, and you could go and you could try it at least on premise somewhere. And it wouldn't be as costly as, say, like a 20-year now, they're wanting however many thousands of dollars for a 20-year bottle. You could get it for, you know, a few hundred instead, you know, and at least you could taste it.
Absolutely. I'll admit I was on the secondary markets for a bit just to expand the collection, to find a couple of things I couldn't find, to get samples, things like that. And I've, as of now, I'm basically completely off of it. And I'll admit to be on, there's one group I'm in because I'm still looking for my own Old Crow Chessmen piece. Mm. And I saw 5 of them go up the other day. And I was just like, I don't, couldn't afford them at the moment. So I got to hope that they keep popping up. But that's pretty much it. Yeah. Like, as you said, it's just priced out. Everything is so ridiculously overpriced.
That's too bad because we do make it for people to enjoy. Yeah. And I mean, I guess it's, it's a twofold thing. It's a good and a bad thing, I guess.
Yeah. And I can definitely say that Michter's products in particular, if we were to pick apart, brand by brand or product line by product line, I would say Michter's is consistently one of the higher demand. And as you said, it's for good and bad, but clearly people want the products and know that they're good. And look, I've got a bunch on my shelf. So
yeah, hopefully in the future we'll be able to get more production out there, which obviously we will, because right now we're getting to the time where it's the production that we did ourselves in our own facility. So we have a little bit more volume, and that will increase hopefully over time and be able to get it out to more people.
Definitely. All right. I think why don't we switch tracks a little bit? We'll go to your time at Beam. And with this, I actually want to start at the point where you were thinking of joining Beam and work forward from there. So Des, how did you end up at Beam?
Well, that's an interesting story. We have to go back one more step, I think, because my husband and I obviously were originally from the Syracuse area, and how we ended up in Kentucky to begin with is how that story kind of starts. We were transferred with another company. I worked for a company called Crucible Specialty Metals. It was a steel mill in Syracuse, a big steel mill in Syracuse, specialty steel. And my husband, that's actually where I met my husband. So that was kind of a twofold, really kind of a, I got to meet the love of my life at my job. So that was kind of neat. But anyway, we were offered a transfer to Kentucky to a plant they had there. And it was a magnetics plant. My husband was going to be plant manager, and they offered me a supervisor's role there. I was a supervisor, metallurgical supervisor in the lab up there in Syracuse. And so they transferred us down to Kentucky, to Elizabethtown, which is about 50 miles south of Louisville. And my husband ran the plant. I was a supervisor. We were there for several years, and ultimately they had decided they were going to close that plant and sell it. So we had to make a decision. Did we want to go back, or did we want to stay where we were? And we decided we loved Kentucky. We loved the area. Weren't into snow anymore, and decided to stay in Kentucky. So when we made that decision, we said, you know, one of us needs to find another job here, because both of us can't be at the same place and lose our jobs at the same time. So he was the plant manager. He was there till the end. So we decided that I needed to find a new job. He kept telling me I was more marketable. I guess that's a good way to say he didn't want to look for another job. But anyway, so I was a supervisor and went out, and I knew this lady that was in an employment agency. And she said, you know, Jim Beam's always looking for good supervisors. In fact, she goes, I know they got a few openings right now. Give me your resume. I'll bring it to the guy over there. Jack Allen was his name, the head of HR. So Jack called me. I had a 45-minute interview, phone interview with him. He brought me in, and I had interviews with the plant manager, two distillery managers. At the time, I didn't even know what the supervisor's job was, but there were two distillery supervisor jobs open. One was second shift, and one was what they called a relief supervisor. Well, I never worked a shift in my life. I always worked day shift. And at this point, I was 40 years old at the time. And I thought, oh, can I do this, work a shift? I don't know if I could do this, you know, and everybody's scared of shifts. But anyway, so they hired me, and they gave me the option of either job. So I ended up taking the relief supervisor job. And the reason I took it was, it was all different shifts. And what I did is I relieved all the different people at both plants. So I relieved people on all different shifts, all different times. And when I wasn't relieving, though, that this is what interested me. I got to work with the master distiller, and they let me be his quote unquote assistant, for lack of a better word, you know, administrative assistant, so to speak. I would do projects for him, things like that. So I said, this sounds really interesting. I don't want to be on a second shift, stuck on second shift somewhere and doing, you know, the same thing every night. This would be interesting. I can learn both plants, because it was rotating back and forth from the main plant to the Booker No plant. And so I said, you know, this sounds very interesting. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Especially because I got to work with Jerry Dalton and the projects that he had me do. I got to work in the warehouse. I got to work in bottling on bottling projects. So I got to learn all about the whole distillery, not just the little distillery department. And it was terrific. My education was accelerated on distillery knowledge because I was learning about all different things and from the master himself. And I always say it was the worst job I ever had, but the one I loved the most, if that makes sense. It doesn't make sense. But anyway, I loved it. I loved going to work. I loved all the projects. I loved learning all the different shifts. And because every shift had a different responsibility at Beam, or different parts of making yeast or different parts of making the product. So I got to learn them all. And then ultimately from there, I got promoted to actually the lead supervisor, which was day shift. And I was responsible for all the other supervisors and the plant. And it was at Booker No. And so that's where I kind of got my start at Booker No. And I was at Booker permanently, and then got promoted from lead supervisor to distillery manager. And that's where I was actually the distillery manager for, I think, the last 8 years, 7 or 8 years that I was there. So that was the ultimate, and that's probably as high as I would have gone, because nobody at Beam gets to be master distiller unless your last name is No. So that wasn't, I mean, that's why I say when you asked about that being in my thought process, if it really wasn't, because it was never an opportunity for me. So I never really gave it a thought.
Well, so I have to then, to challenge you on that one, because as you said, it's hard to become master distiller of Beam without being either a No or a Beam or something like that. But exactly. You had the chance to work with Jerry Dalton.
Yeah, and I did.
And I'm curious what, you know, obviously just, I've never really spoken or heard about the man. So obviously what was like working with him, but also what it was like working with someone who was master distiller but not a No.
Yeah, it was interesting. At the time, Fred was I guess what they called him at the time was ambassador. So he did like a lot of the traveling and talking to people and stuff, but they felt like, I guess his experience was enough yet to make him master. I really don't know their thought process on that. I shouldn't even speak to it. Eventually, you know, Jerry left and he became it, but Jerry was science-based. He had a doctorate in chemistry and a doctorate in something else, physics, maybe it was. I mean, he was a really, really smart man. And he was big into statistics and in all of the reasons why things happened. You know, up until that point, you know, I always say distilling is part art, part science. You know, it's part just feeling and knowing what to do. And it's also part factual, where you actually have scientific information to help you along. And Jerry was very, very into the science of the whole distillery plant. And so I did studies with him that were terrific. I mean, like barrel recovery studies where the angel share, statistically looking at the angel share and what was contributing to that and things like that, you know, and working with barrel suppliers. And so I got to do a lot of things that I would not have normally done as a distillery supervisor, and no other supervisor would have gotten to do those things. But Jerry needed help, and they decided that this was a good way to give him some help. And my background, I had a business degree. Believe it or not, I did not have a science degree. I had a business degree. So my background was in business and statistics. And so I was very helpful to Jerry because I understood what he was talking about in the statistic portion of it and could relate and pull out, you know, different information that was needed by the plant manager or the distillery managers at that time. There were two of those. There's always two distillery managers at Beam, one at Booker No and one at Claremont. But it like so enhanced my education in distilling, because the science part of it, even though, I took a lot of science classes in college and that sort of thing, I didn't have a science degree, but I learned from him the science portion that I was missing. So at the time, the HR manager did that on purpose, is what I found out later. They were making teams and they wanted the teams to be strong. And so they could have a business person, a biology person, a chemistry person. And so each one, a couple of the other guys had the biology and chemistry degrees in the distillery. I had a business degree, so I would help them and they would help me. That was the whole idea of creating these teams, and they would all grow together. And it actually really worked well for Beam. I think Booker No had one of the best teams. Of course, then people started retiring and then things get all messed up. But, you know, while we were doing that, we really excelled and moved the process forward, I believe.
I mean, that's, again, it's a lens that I have not yet or not before heard or talked about. So, thank you for talking about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's very interesting.
So I know we are getting to the top of the hour and I don't want to keep you too long, but I think let's, one more person I wanted to talk to you about, and you've spoken about him intermittently, of course, is just working with Willie Pratt. And of course we lost him last year.
Yes.
Which was of course very sad in itself. It's a great loss to the whiskey industry.
Sure.
He's someone who I'll be honest, I don't know that much about other than his time at Michter's and his nickname of Dr. No and
things like that.
So I'd just love to hear what your experience was like working with him, beyond what you've said already about him, which has been very, very positive, of course.
Willie was a character. He's a hard character to describe. Tough man when it came to wanting things done a certain way. He was very regimented in that and very methodical. He was knowledgeable beyond comprehension in warehousing and barrels and anything to do with that. Don't get me wrong, he had knowledge in all of the distillery, but that's where his expertise truly shone. He had been around so long that he probably forgot more than I would even know to this day. He was a character. He was hilarious, to be honest. We had a lot of fun with him. He was not easy to work for sometimes because he demanded that you do things in a certain way, and he demanded excellence. And that's okay. I'm okay with that. I guess they say I'm hard to work for sometimes too, for the same reason. But he was also a teddy bear. You know, if you knew him and got to know him, he could be a very compassionate man and very kind. He was also very tough. So there were many facets to Willie, but his knowledge, I mean, I learned a lot from him about warehousing and barrels and, you know, all of that. Because that was my weak spot. You know, everybody has a weak spot. That was my weak spot. He did a lot for Michter's. He started it from the ground up, you know. I was like the fifth person on board. They had Willie, they had an accountant. and a couple of two or three other people. One was a maintenance guy. One was a guy who worked in processing modeling. So there were very few people on board. Willie was the leader. You know, he was the true leader of the gang. And he got us on the right track. And then I was able to continue that track and add, hopefully, some of my knowledge to that and, you know, help make the product what it is today.
Wonderful. And so we'll close that with a question that I hope you will enjoy exploring with me, which is simply, you've held these, so many different positions and different aspects of companies, and particularly when not coming from, let's say, a chemical engineering background or distilling background, and yet ending up as a master distiller.
Yeah.
Along that timeline, that path, if you could go back, let's give you a cheat code and say you can choose the hours and the shift that you can use. But if you could choose one job to go back to that, and you won't get in trouble for saying this, if it's one or the other or another, if you could choose one job to go back to, what do you think would be the most attractive for you?
I want to say the lead supervisor at Beam. And the reason I say that is not because it's Beam, the lead supervisor anywhere. I loved being on the floor, day to day. I love the day to day industry and the problem solving and all of the problems that came with the lead supervisor, whether it's personnel or equipment problems or whatever. I loved problem solving. I loved being able to interact with the people, the operators, the people on the floor. That was where I was most comfortable, and it was what I liked doing the best. Not that I didn't like all the promotions and all of that, but I honestly say that was probably where I would have been in my comfort zone. That's my comfort zone. Behind the scenes, in doing this job, you know, and just making the whiskey the best that I could with everyone's help. We were a team. We had great times. We had fun times. Not that I didn't have fun times other times, but I just loved that job, the challenge of it and the camaraderie of it. I loved it.
It's really wonderful to hear. If the video will be available for Patreon subscribers, and your expression in your face during that particular question, you could see when people talk about their favorite jobs and that place that they just felt so comfortable, that's exactly what I saw. So Pam, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Hold on for a second after we stop recording, just so I can close some things up. But
okay.
Again, thank you for taking the time. It seems like you're exactly where you want to be right now, which is right, you know,
right in Florida.
In Florida. Hey.
In Florida. All my kids were in Florida.
Hey, look, my mom moved down to Florida 2 years ago, just before COVID. I feel you on that one. Me personally, I can't take humidity, so you'll never see me moving down there. But I'll pop in from time to time to visit for sure.
But yeah.
Pam, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for asking. I appreciated it and enjoyed it very much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of the Whiskering Podcast, and we'll talk to you soon.